So, on a cosmic scale, there are controllers of different universal affairs. We may not be aware of it, but there are controllers for different departments within the universe, just like there are controllers for different departments within the state. And the controllers are known as Ishwaras or Devatas. For example, Brahma is in charge of creation. Shiva is in charge of destruction. Indra is in charge of rainfall. Vayu is in charge of the air. Varuna is in charge of the waters. And even in more subtle ways, Saraswati is in charge of music and culture and knowledge. So these are all Ishwaras. But Ishwara Parama Krishna, Krishna is the supreme controller. Everyone is under the control of Krishna, directly or indirectly. But Krishna is not under the control of anyone. Now, someone may question, I'm talking about different controllers, different demigods. How do we know they exist? Is it some mythology? How can we believe that they exist? Well, the Vedic literatures explain that there are different methods for acquiring knowledge. One method is direct perception, what we see through our bare senses. But direct perception is not reliable. For example, we can look in the sky and see the moon at night. It will just be a small disk. But actually, the moon is a huge body, or the sun. So what we perceive through our senses directly is not reliable. And then again, our senses are limited in their range of perception. For example, there are pitches that are too high for us to hear. This is the principle of dog whistles. The dog can hear the whistle because his senses are attuned to that frequency, but we cannot hear it. So in the same way, there are so many vibrations of sound, light, and so on that are just beyond the range of our senses to experience. And then there's the difficulty if something is too far, we can't see it. Even if something is too near, we can't see it. Like our own eyelashes, we can't see, or our eyelids, we can't see. So direct perception is defective. Then another process is called anuman, or inference. For example, we hear the sound of a motor in the background, and we can infer that it was a car, that a car was passing. But actually, we don't know. It could have been that one of the neighbors turned on a machine that made a blowing sound that resembled the sound of a car. Once I went on a walk, probably many of you have had the same experience, I went on a walk with a friend at, he was studying at Cambridge University. And in the background there was a sound. And he said that it was the sound of the ocean. And it sounded like the sound of the ocean. But actually, it was the sound of traffic in the distance. And sometimes when we walk on the beach in Santa Barbara and we hear the traffic, but we try to imagine or that it's the sound of the ocean, and it could just as well be. So we perceive something, a sound, as we've been discussing, for example, and we infer that it's a car passing by, or it's the sound of the ocean. But actually, it could be something else. So the best evidence, or the best process for receiving knowledge, according to the Vedic analysis, is shabda. Shabda means transcendental sound vibration. Or, in other words, Vedic sounds that emanate from a higher realm that is beyond the deficiencies of human intellect and human senses. And the Vedic sounds convey eternal truths. And such eternal truths are beyond our ability to know through our senses, through direct perception, or through our minds or intelligence, through inference or logic and reason. And the information that we receive by shabda, transcendental sound vibrations, is considered the best way to receive knowledge, or you could even say perfect knowledge, because it originates in a realm that is beyond human imperfection. So, the Bhagavad Gita and other Vedic literatures present knowledge that is beyond our sense perception and beyond our logic and reason and inference. But it is not beyond the perception or cognition of realized souls. And therefore, in the Vedic system, although the central point is shabda, which is recorded in Vedic literatures, we also have the authority of self-realized souls, or acharyas. And they, because of their purified senses and purified intelligence, are able to perceive directly the truths mentioned in the Vedas. And therefore, their words are considered as authoritative as the Vedas. And their words serve to confirm the Vedic conclusions. So, here maybe we could give the example of a radio. Right now, there are radio waves in the atmosphere, but we cannot perceive them unless we have an instrument that can transform them into a form that we can perceive, namely the radio. So in the same way, there are realities that exist beyond our ability to perceive with our present instruments, with these limited eyes and ears and nose and mouth and skin and so on. But the soul has within it the inherent capacity to directly perceive and realize eternal truth. But to realize that capacity, one has to undergo a process. And the process, again, there could be a whole discussion, but the conclusion from the Vedic literatures is that the process, ultimate process, is bhakti yoga. In bhakti yoga, one engages the senses in the service of Krishna, who is the proprietor of the senses. Rishikena, Rishikena, Sevanam, Bhakti Ruchate. We have these senses, but they don't belong to us. They've been given to us. And they can be taken away. Our ability to see can be taken away. Our ability to hear can be taken away. So who do the senses belong to? Ultimately, the senses belong to Krishna, because he is the origin of everything. Sarva karana karanam. He is the cause of all causes. We may say, well, I got my body from my mother, or from the combination of my mother and father. But my parents also have their parents, and their parents also have their parents, who are their cause. So when we go back further and further to the original cause, Anadir Adir Govinda, he is the origin of everything, but he himself has no origin. Sarva Karana Karanam. He is the prime cause of all causes. So because he is the prime cause of all causes, he is the cause of our senses. He is the origin of our senses, and therefore he is the proprietor of our senses. And therefore our senses are meant to be used as he ordains. And he wishes that our senses be engaged in his service. Not that he needs our service for himself. There's nothing we can offer him that he doesn't already have. We're offering him some flowers, or we're offering him some fruits. But he is, by his will, he can create innumerable flowers and innumerable fruits, innumerable planets with innumerable flowering bushes and fruit-bearing trees. So he doesn't need our fruits and flowers, but we need to engage our senses in the service of Krishna, and therefore we grow flowers to offer to him, or we go to the market and buy flowers to offer him, but we're engaging our senses in his service. And by such service, devotional service or bhakti yoga, our senses become purified. It's a gradual process. But when our senses are fully purified, we can see Krishna face to face. We can perceive Krishna just as he's described in the Vedic literatures. But until then, we hear about Krishna from the Vedic literatures, and hearing about Krishna is also part of bhakti yoga. In fact, hearing about Krishna means engaging our sense of hearing in Krishna's service. And the words enter our ears, the vibrations enter our ears, but ultimately, they go to our mind, and thus our minds become purified. Our spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, has given the example that when we hear the chanting of Hare Krishna or hear the discussions of Krishna from Bhagavad Gita or other Vedic literatures, our ears are acting like an antenna, like a television antenna. And our mind is acting like the screen on which the image is seen. And we, the soul, who's living within the body that's made of the mind and senses, we are the audience. So the transcendental sound that enters the ear is sort of manifest within the mind. And then the soul perceives it. The soul perceives it. And gradually, as the mind and senses become purified, we come to realize that the holy name of Krishna or the topics of Krishna are the same as Krishna. Nama Chintamani Krishna Chaitanya Rasa Vigraha. The holy name of Krishna and Krishna himself are the same. I often give the example that Srila Prabhupada gave to us, that in the material world or the relative world, the name of an object and the object are different. For example, if I'm thirsty, if I'm in the desert and I'm thirsty and I chant, water, 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 water. Well, just chanting water, water will not quench my thirst, because the word water and the substance water are different. But in the spiritual realm, or the absolute realm, the name of the thing and the thing are the same. So when I chant Krishna, Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna is personally present, dancing on my tongue. And therefore, by chanting Hare Krishna, we are getting the association of Krishna. And because Krishna is supremely pure, Bhagavad Gita says, Param Brahma Param Dhamma Pavitram Paramam Bhavan. He is supremely pure. So by associating with him, we become purified. Krishna is also supremely joyful. And by associating with him, we also become joyful. Here the example is given of an iron rod in fire. The iron rod by nature is cold and hard. But when you put the iron rod in fire, by association with the fire, it becomes hotter and hotter until finally it becomes red hot. And then it no longer acts as iron, it acts as fire. If something touches it, it will burn. So in the same way, by placing ourselves in the fire of Krishna consciousness, by constantly chanting Hare Krishna, hearing about Krishna and thinking of Krishna in different ways, by placing ourselves in the fire of Krishna consciousness, we gradually become spiritualized or Krishnaized until we're red hot, so to speak. We have the same qualities as Krishna. Just as the red-hot iron has the same qualities as fire, similarly, we manifest the same qualities as Krishna. So, Ishvara Parama Krishna Sat Chit Ananda Vigraha. Sat means eternal. Chit means knowledge. Ananda means bliss. And Vigraha means form. He is the form, you could say the personification, of eternal existence, perfect knowledge, and supreme bliss. And by associating with Krishna, we develop the same qualities, Sat-Chit Ananda. We also become eternal. Of course, the body is perishable, but the soul within the body is eternal. And when we become completely purified, the soul manifests a spiritual body, just like Krishna's. And we can actually realize our spiritual bodies even while we're in the physical body. And there the example is given of a coconut, that when the coconut is young, the flesh of the coconut is attached to the shell. But when the coconut becomes more mature, the flesh becomes hardened, and then it separates from the shell of the coconut. You can shake the coconut and hear the inside. So in the same way, the spiritual body develops within the physical body. And it can actually exist within the physical body. And therefore, the self-realized soul, although outwardly he appears like anyone else in a physical body, but he's actually developed his spiritual body. And he can perceive through spiritual senses Krishna and all the eternal truths of the Vedas. And then at the time of death, he leaves the body, and the soul leaves the body. That's true for anyone. But with the realized soul, the soul leaves the body and goes to the supreme abode of Krishna. And there, the self-realized soul manifests his spiritual body, which is suitable for serving Krishna, because Krishna also exists there in his spiritual body. But it doesn't mean that we become equal to Krishna. We are equal in quality. He is Sat-Chit Ananda, and we are also Sat-Chit Ananda. But the difference is that he is great and we are small. He is infinite, and in comparison we are infinitesimal. So there the example is given of say, a particle of gold with the gold in the mine. The particle of gold is of the same quality as the reservoir of gold in the mine. But the quantity is different. Or another example is the sparks of a fire. The spark has the same quality as the fire. But the spark is small and the fire is big. A spark can fall out of the fire, and then its fiery quality is lost. But the same cinder, if we put it back into the fire, it becomes reignited and then it dances in the fire. So in the same way, we have somehow fallen away from God, and our fiery quality or our eternal, blissful, spiritual nature has been lost temporarily. But if we go back into the fire, we will again manifest the same qualities as the fire, although we'll always remain a tiny cinder. We will never be equal to the whole fire. So we've all had a little taste of chanting here tonight. It's very pleasant, as you have experienced. At the end of the singing, I heard one of the people behind me just sort of exclaim, "That was beautiful." And probably she wasn't the only one who felt the same way. So it's, that is one difference between bhakti yoga and other types of self-realization, that the process itself is pleasant. Very pleasant. Kevala ananda kanda. It is simply joyful. Chanting, discussing philosophy, taking prasad, vegetarian food that has been offered to Krishna, and by the transcendental process it becomes Krishnaized also, and therefore eating the prasad is part of bhakti yoga. It purifies the senses. It purifies the tongue. So we can spiritualize or Krishnaize all of our activities in a very pleasant way. And in the end, we will achieve the supreme perfection. Now, someone may say, it sounds too easy. And of course, in the modern age, everything, well, not everything, but almost everything is complicated. So it sounds too easy. But that's the way it is. Although there is a little austerity required, not much, but a little austerity. No eating meat. And again, we could go into the reasons why these austerities are required. But just in brief, no eating meat, fish or eggs, no gambling, no intoxication, and no illicit sex. But even then, if you just chant and hear about Krishna, engage in the other activities, which are so pleasant, even just remaining the way you are, if you just add the process of Krishna consciousness, gradually you'll lose the taste for such things and you'll give them up yourself. Nobody will have to tell you. So you don't need to be frightened that, oh, ooh, I can't live without these things. You know, I mean, I can chant, but I can't live without these things. Well, don't worry. You know, you can chant and do those things. And if you don't give them up, that's okay too, because in your next life you'll get another chance. But if you do give them up and chant purely, then you may not even have a next life in the material world. So you'll go back home, back to Godhead, back to Krishna. Hare Krishna. So are there any questions or comments? Yes.
Yes, Maharaj. Is it possible? I mean, I know it's not easy, but is there some way that could be speeded up not to come back here again? I don't really mean speed it up, but I mean enough awareness to not have to come back so many times.
Well, the process of liberation is bhakti yoga, or Krishna consciousness. There's a very important verse and relevant verse in Bhagavad Gita. Janma karma chame divyam evam yo veti tatvataha tyaktya deham purnar janma naiti mameti so Arjuna. One who understands the transcendental nature of Lord Krishna's birth and activities never has to take birth again, but he goes to Krishna. So I've spoken on Janmashtami in the past, and in a way, I've spoken more directly about Krishna's appearance in the material world and Krishna's activities in the material world. And if we understand them, we are liberated. Chaktya Dehang Purnarjanma. Purnarjanma means repeated birth. Chaktya Deha. Deha means body. Chaktya means upon leaving. Upon leaving the body, Chaktya Deha Purnarjanma Naiti. He has no more to take birth again. Mameti, but he comes to me. Krishna is the speaker of Bhagavad Gita, so he comes to Krishna. But in order to understand Krishna in truth, one has to engage in devotional service. It's not an intellectual process that one can read a book and understand Krishna's birth and activities, tattvata, in truth. And in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, bhaktimam abhijanati, that he can actually be understood by bhakti yoga. So again, we come back to the same process. Hearing about Krishna. Hearing means also reading about Krishna. Chanting Hare Krishna. And serving Krishna in different ways. And that is the process. It may seem simple, and it is simple, but it's actually very powerful. One can become liberated almost unconsciously. Srila Prabhupada gave the example that a passenger may get on an airplane, and he's sitting down, you know, maybe he's reading the newspaper, talking to his friend next to him, you know, or now looking in his computer, and he thinks nothing's happening. But then after a while, he looks out the window and he sees, you know, he's way above where he was. So Krishna consciousness can be like that. You're doing the same things. You're talking about Krishna. You're reading about Krishna. You're eating Krishna prasad. Everything seems the same. And you may not even notice how you are changing. But when you look out the window and you see what you were before and what you are now, you say, whoa, I've come a long way. So it works on a subtle platform. And it is powerful. It's like taking a medicine. You're not conscious of how it works, but it works. And other processes, the complicated ones, the difficult ones, you know, they're like, you know, whatever, you know, physical therapy or surgery or, you know, they have all sorts of procedures now. This is just like taking the medicine. And it works. Any other questions or comments? Have I ever seen Krishna as a person? Well, I mean, I suppose, yes, there are indirect ways and direct ways. Now here we have the deity of Krishna. And according to one's consciousness, one can either see the deity as a statue made of stone, or one can see the deity as Krishna. So, the more we become Krishna conscious, the more we see the deity as Krishna, and the less we see the deity as a stone statue. Sometimes people would ask Srila Prabhupada, have you seen Krishna? And sometimes he would answer that if I tell you that I've seen Krishna, how will you know if I'm telling the truth? If I say falsely that, yes, I've seen Krishna, will you believe me? And usually the answer is no. And therefore, and then Srila Prabhupada would say, then what is the use of the question? I mean, I would say that it's just, once somebody, there's a big festival in India called the Kumbh Mela. You might have heard of it. Maybe even some of you have attended it or seen pictures of it. But anyway, we were at Kumbh Mela with Srila Prabhupada, and we were very new in India. We were quite naive. And one holy man came to our camp, and he spoke the philosophy of Bhagavad Gita quite similar to the Bhagavad Gita as it is. And he followed the same principles, and he said that he had seen Krishna. So we were, as I said, young, new in India, and we went to Srila Prabhupada and told him about the man who'd come to our camp. And when we said what the philosophy that he presented, Prabhupada said, very good. When we told Prabhupada about the principles that he followed, Prabhupada said, very good. But when we told Prabhupada that he said that he had seen Krishna, then Prabhupada said, he may be bogus. Because in our line, we don't say, I've seen Krishna. Because anyone can say, I've seen Krishna falsely. And how will you know? So that's an answer. But the scriptures do give descriptions of the qualification for seeing Krishna. And the qualification is having love for Krishna. So I cannot say that I have love for Krishna, but I do believe that Srila Prabhupada had love for Krishna, and consequently, I believe that he could see Krishna directly, face to face.
Yes, can I just make a comment to further what you were saying?
Sure, sure.
About our line, the direct disciples of Lord Chaitanya, the six Goswamis, were completely pure, completely renounced, and there's one verse about them that says, Hey Rat, Hey Brajadevike, Chalalite, Hey Nandasuna Kutaha. And that means that Srimati Radharani, where are you? Are you on the bank of the... And Sri Krishna, where are you now? Are you on the bank of the Jamuna? Are you at Govardhan Hill? Where are you? So Srila Prabhupada comments that this is our line, that we are vipralambra, in feeling separation for God, wondering, experiencing separation, and therefore it's not, you know, now I found Krishna, my work is finished. It's a constant searching for, as Gurudeva Swami was saying, for the service of Radha and Krishna.
Very good. Bhagavad Prabhu?
I was just remembering something Prabhupada said. It was very beautiful. He said that, don't be so eager to see Krishna. But make yourself so beautiful that Krishna becomes eager to see you.
Yes, very good point. First, Bhagavad Prabhu quoted our spiritual master that we should not be anxious to see Krishna, but we should act in such a way that Krishna wants to see us. You know, just like if you if you want to see the President of the United States, anyway. Say you want to see, well, all right. Say in an idealized situation, you want to see the President of the United States. It's not so easy to meet the President of the United States. But if you distinguish yourself by your service to the nation, then the President himself will invite you and he'll want to see you. So that's the idea. That we cannot force God to appear before us, no matter how pure we are. But if we serve God in such a way that he wants to see us, then who can stop him from coming to see us? But Bhargava Prabhu asked for me to give an example of a pastime of Krishna where a devotee was able to directly see Krishna. And I will tell one briefly in relation to the deity of Krishna and how the deity of Krishna is Krishna himself. In brief, an elderly Brahmin means like a priest or a spiritual teacher. Say teacher. Brahmin means teacher. So an older Brahmin went on a pilgrimage to Vrindavan, which is Lord Krishna's birthplace. And a younger Brahmin accompanied him and served him. And the older Brahmin was so pleased with his service that he offered him his daughter in marriage. Of course, there's a whole cultural context to the idea of an arranged marriage, which we won't discuss now. But it was current at the time, and it, in general, it worked well, I think better than what's going on now. So the difficulty was that the Brahmin came from a very wealthy and aristocratic family, the older one, and the younger one came from a more humble family. So the Brahmin's wife was incensed that he offered their daughter in marriage to such a poor person. And then the brother of the girl, the son, you know, he was very aggressive and saying, no, we cannot let our sister marry such a poor fellow. So the younger Brahmin felt bad, not because he particularly wanted to marry the girl as such, but because the older Brahmin had promised in front of the deity, that they came in front of the deity of Krishna and Vrindavan, and in front of the deity, the older Brahmin, who was so pleased with the service of the younger Brahmin, offered the daughter. So there was a big commotion, and finally, the older Brahmin, to pacify the family, yes, that's right. So the brother was saying, you know, where's the witness? That's right. He was saying, where's the witness? The young man is making up the whole story. You know, he wants to marry into a rich family. He wants to marry my sister. He's making up the whole story. Where's the witness? So the young Brahmin said the witness was the deity of Krishna in Vrindavan. So if the deity of Krishna comes to testify that, yes, your father offered his daughter to me in marriage, will you accept it? So, you know, the son was delighted with this proposal because he was basically an atheist. He was a materialist. So he thought, how can the deity of Krishna give testimony? How can he bear witness? So he said, yeah, that's fine. So they went back to Vrindavan to the deity of Krishna. And they were like very pure. They approached Krishna and they said, do you remember when the older Brahmin promised his daughter to me in marriage? The deity said, yes. So now his family doesn't believe us, so you have to come and bear witness. So the deity said, well, I'm just a deity. You know, how can I walk all the way to Orissa? The family was from Orissa. So then the Brahmin said, well, if you can talk, you can walk also. So the deity said, yes, you're right. So the deity said, I will follow behind you on the condition that you don't look back. It's sort of like testing his faith. But you will know that I'm walking behind you from the sound of my ankle bells. So they started to walk back to Orissa, and when they got to the border of the town, the Brahmin couldn't hear the sound of the ankle bells anymore, and he sort of started wondering whether the whole thing was just in his mind. So he stopped and he turned around, and there was the deity of Krishna. So then, you know, the news spread that the deity had walked all the way from Vrindavan, and the family and all the townspeople came, and the deity bore witness to the old Brahmin's promise. And the deity is still there. The deity is called Shakshi Gopal. Gopal means Krishna, and Shakshi means witness. And later, you know, they built a simple temple for the deity, and later a king built a nice temple for the deity, and the deity is still there. So this is one of many stories, but it also illustrates that the deity is Krishna if you have the eyes to see or the ears to hear. Any other questions or comments? Okay, well, no, you begin because you started, and then...
I was just commenting that, you know, I was at the Getty Museum the other day, and I saw 100 images probably of Christ, so many different images, and how would one even know if one has some spiritual vision or dream, and some being came to you that you thought was Krishna, how would one even know or verify that? Because we have so many projections of these great beings. So many images and so many paintings and images and deities and figures and statues, and each one's unique.
You're asking how one would identify Krishna?
Even if one did have someone
showed up. Oh, yeah. Well, no, there are basic features of Krishna described in the scriptures. Now, the fact that one artist's rendition will be a little different from another artist's rendition is of no consequence. Even if you take, oh boy, I don't know why we keep coming back to the poor president, but, you know,
He's not poor.
We're the poor ones. You know, if you went to a gallery of paintings of the president, for example, no two paintings would be the same because each artist will have his own style. But still, there will be features, even in the cartoons. You know, the caricatures are different, but there's no doubt about the person being referred to in the cartoon. And when you see him, you know he's the one. Last question.
It was Mahavendra Puri. Was Lord Chaitanya alive when he was alive? When he was underneath the tree and fasting and chanting, and Krishna came to him and he asked him what kind of meditation he was undergoing. Was he taking milk? Was he eating? What kind of food he sucked up? He went on and on and on and on, you know, telling him about the people in the village. Some fast on milk, some fast on nothing, some eat food. You know, the guy was a pretty high cat. But I read the book twice, and I can't remember if Lord Chaitanya was alive when he was going through this thing, like when he saw Krishna. When he was told to get the deity out of the jungle because it was burning on fire, it was so hot in there, and to wash it, you know, 10,000 times or something, whatever they had to do to it, to make it a nice, you know, nice and cool and worship it. Was Lord Chaitanya alive when he was alive?
He's referring to Madhavendra Puri, who was the spiritual master of the spiritual master of Lord Chaitanya. And again, Lord Chaitanya is actually Krishna, but in the guise of a devotee, to show us by practical example how to worship Krishna in the modern age. Considering when Madhavendra Puri was present, and then his disciple was Ishwara Puri,
right.
and Lord Chaitanya accepted Ishwara Puri as his spiritual master, I don't really know the dates, but I don't really know the dates, but it's... Do you know?
Yes, I'm pretty, almost positive. Didn't Lord Nityananda take initiation from Madhavendra Puri?
Yeah.
So then Lord Chaitanya was alive.
Wow.
Because Lord Chaitanya took initiation from Ishwara Puri, but Lord Nityananda took initiation from Madhavendra Puri.
So, yeah. He was older. But we'll tentatively accept your statement.
Yeah, he was out there. He was definitely lost. The love got him.
Yes, Madhavendra Puri was filled with love of Godhead. He's another example of a rare soul to whom Krishna appeared. He was the one who manifests the intense mood of separation from Krishna. And from then on, of course, through Lord Chaitanya and then the followers of Lord Chaitanya, the mood of separation has continued. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
You have a very learned and elevated audience here. And it has been an honor and pleasure to be able to discuss Krishna with all of you. Hare Krishna.
Thank you very much. So now we're going to have a short... a very ancient traditional ceremony. It's called Arti. And it's offering certain items to Lord Krishna. And at the same time, we will be offering the entire feast to Krishna. Usually we make up We're just letting him glance over all of it in this case. So, and then we're going to do the beautiful ceremony. And after that, and I'm going to lead the chanting for that. And after that, then we will enjoy Krishna's birthday feast. Does that sound good?
Yeah.
All right. I want to thank here in the audience, Revati, who did the beautiful altar arrangement for